you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 167 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyra, once again, your host for the day. Today, my guest is Margot Roberts. Margot is a solo practitioner in the Baltimore City area who focuses in on guardianship law. And I have to admit, this is a practice area that I don't know a whole heck of a lot about. And so we spent a lot of time educating me as to what guardianship law is all about and how a solo practitioner can affect a successful practice. And I hope you enjoy hearing about that as much as I did. And without any further delay, here's Margot Roberts. Margot Roberts, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Hi, Neil. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. How about yourself?
Doing just fine this morning.
Awesome. I'm glad you could join us today, Margot. Tell our audience a little bit about yourself and how you came to be where you are today.
Sure, Neil. So I'm a practicing solo practitioner in Baltimore City. I went to law school. I started in 2010. And the story that I like to tell the most is how I almost left law school after the first year. I decided to work full-time while I was in law school, and I started out with a solo criminal defense attorney, actually, in Columbia. And I realized after about a year and a half with him that if that was going to be my practice, that I didn't want to practice.
Right.
And so I was with him for a year and a half, got through the first year of law school, which, of course, everyone wants to walk away after the first year of law school.
Mine was after the first semester. That was my crisis of confidence.
And I said, you know, I've got to make a change, do something different if I'm going to continue on. And of course, my older brother is an attorney, and he said, Margot, everyone hates the first year. You'll be fine. You just need to stick with it. But in August of 2011, I had a friend of mine say, hey, this firm on my floor, they do guardianship work, and they're looking for a full-time clerk. Would you be interested in me passing your name along? And I said, sure. I don't know anything about guardianship. I don't have any experience in that. But I ended up making the interview and making the cut. And I've been doing guardianship practice, obviously after I got out of law school and then passed the bar. And now I would say probably 50% of my practice is guardianship work.
Now, I'm going to have to make a confession that, you know, other than filing a petition for guardianship, I'm not entirely sure what the practice area of guardianship law entails. Can you help educate me?
Sure. So the filing of a guardianship petition is really just kind of starting the race. It's a much longer process. I mean, once you have a guardianship in place, that really is the starting point for overseeing the guardianship. And what you may or may not know is that once a guardianship proceeding is instituted, it's actually the court that's the ultimate guardian. And so they have to oversee the process from the moment the guardian is appointed, whether it be to make financial decisions, medical decisions, or both. But there's periodic reporting. I mean, there are guardianships that last for decades and are before the court for a very long period of time. So really that filing the petition, although it's difficult and complicated, I don't want to downplay that. It's really just kind of the starting off point.
So, I mean, what I hear is that there's a step involved in petitioning the court to have a guardian appointed. But beyond that, there's the administration of the guardianship that, you know, depends on who has been appointed as a guardian. I'm assuming that if a family member petitions using the services of an attorney such as yourself, if a family member petitions to be appointed guardian, then they're the ones that are going to be under the jurisdiction of the court for the benefit of the ward. Is that correct?
That's correct. It's an agency relationship.
Sure.
The person who is given the title as guardian is really only the agent of the court who is the ultimate guardian.
Yeah.
And you bring up a significant point as well. If there is a family member who is petitioning to be a guardian for either, you know, can have guardianships of minors or guardianships of disabled adults as well, there is a hierarchy of folks who are the court will look at for who should be willing to serve. And generally speaking, a family member petitioner is going to have a pretty high priority to serve as guardian. Now, I represent petitioners to obtain guardianship, but my practice is actually more focused on the other side. I serve as guardian of property for disabled adults. And so that means there is no one else willing to serve.
Yeah. I'm going to get to that in a second. I just want to make sure that okay. I understand in my, you know, limited capacity, just exactly where all that fits in. So,
sure.
So I'm guessing that when you file a petition for a guardianship, that it all goes smoothly and there's never any problem, that, you know, the petition is granted almost routinely each and every time. Or is there a lot of litigation? I'm being a little bit facetious there.
I would not go as far to say as it's granted every time, but there are many guardianships that proceed by way of stipulation instead of litigation. Far fewer guardianships are actually litigated than they are stipulated to. I will say most of them, at least in my experience, are usually settled about 15 minutes before the hearing.
Sure. Even the ones that are being litigated, they get resolved on the courthouse steps.
Yes.
Most often.
I would say probably 90 to 95% of the time, even if it looks like it may be a contested matter, there is some resolution that's agreed to right before walking in.
Okay. And then, as you said, there are times, unfortunately and sadly in many cases, that there is no family member or interested party who steps up to be the guardian. And in that case, attorneys like yourself are often appointed. How does that come to be?
In Maryland, every jurisdiction is a little bit different by county and the qualifications needed to serve. Back in 2018, the court actually issued some new rules about those qualifications. Let me take a step back too, for another really important role that we may have missed, and that's as court-appointed counsel. So in a guardianship proceeding for an alleged disabled adult, the statute reads that an attorney must be appointed to represent that alleged disabled adult. And that's partially how it can become adversarial.
Yeah.
And I serve in that role as well. I serve in that role in many different jurisdictions in Maryland. So there are certain qualifications to serve as court-appointed counsel during the guardianship proceeding, and then certain qualifications to serve as guardian of property if the court determines there is no other person willing or able to serve, and they decide that an attorney is the most appropriate person.
Yeah, I kind of liken it in my mind to, in some ways, a best interest attorney for a child in a family law matter. In this case, you're having an attorney who's looking out for the best interest, not to use that phrase exactly, but in general, the best interest of the person for whom the guardianship is being sought.
I think that's a really good comparison. I've been approached a couple of different times to train to be a best interest attorney. Unfortunately, that's just not an area that I'm willing to expand my practice right now.
Right. And then similarly, I think the analogy can be made in serving as the guardian on behalf of a disabled adult. It's not unlike serving as executor or the personal representative of an estate in which there's no family member who's able to take on that role.
You're exactly right. I mean, they're both fiduciaries.
Yeah.
And you're acting on behalf of your ward, or you're acting on behalf of the estate. I do also serve as personal representative from time to time on estates as well. Your fiduciary duty in these types of roles is one of the most critical things you have to think about. And quite frankly, it's one of the reasons why I don't tell people to get into my line of work lightly, because of this great deal of responsibility on behalf of, you know, the disabled adult or even the estate and heirs and things like that. You have a lot of people to answer to for what actions you take. And that can be challenging.
And not the least of which is the court.
There you go.
Yeah.
The court, if the court's unhappy with you, they'll bring you in too.
Today, I'd like to introduce a new sponsor to The Law Entrepreneur, and that's the folks at Jurisdiction. You started your law practice to ditch the firm life and be your own boss, but your practice is running you. The good news, being an attorney entrepreneur doesn't have to be this hard. Jesse and Megan, the lawpreneurs behind Jurisdiction, are working to build a new generation of solo practitioners who love being lawyers. This year, Jurisdiction is introducing a new program, Next Level Law Practice. Next Level Law Practice is a rigorous training program that provides tools and business fundamentals for estate planning attorneys to start and grow a profitable and streamlined legal business. Next Level Law Practice gives you access to videos, worksheets, templates, one-on-one coaching, and live group sessions that allow you to ask questions and learn on your own schedule. To learn more about the program, visit thrivejd.com. That's thrivejd.com. They're even offering an exclusive coupon code for the Law Entrepreneur listeners. Just enter the code TLE150, that's like the Law Entrepreneur 150, for a $150 discount off your course registration. And welcome to the show, Jurisdiction. This episode of The Law Entrepreneur is sponsored by Daylight, the Mac CRM and case management tool I've been using for years to run my practice. If you want to take your practice further, you need to try Daylight. Daylight keeps track of every case detail and reminds you when you need to follow up so you can focus on what matters most. To be honest with you, I can't imagine running my practice without Daylight. So say hello to a stress-free workflow and visit marketcircle.com to try Daylight now. Remember to mention that you heard about Daylight through The Law Entrepreneur to get a 50% discount off your first monthly subscription. So what are the kinds of scenarios that come before you that bring clients to the door? Is it almost always, you know, a disabled adult, or are there other types of guardianships that and other types of scenarios that lend itself to this type of practice?
So strictly speaking, with respect to my guardianship practice, there are two types of guardianships, one for minor children and one for disabled adults. For minor children in the state of Maryland, a minor cannot receive property. And so that situation generally arises when there is an inheritance of some sort, maybe a life insurance proceed or an annuity that someone left to someone who's not 18.
Right.
And a guardianship proceeding has to be instituted in order to accept those funds and then guard them until the minor reaches the age of majority, 18. I do work in that. I do also, so that situation kind of happens just naturally. Maybe grandmother didn't realize she couldn't put the daughter or her grandchild as the beneficiary on her retirement account or something like
sure.
that. So those are generally, how do I put it, less problematic. They're generally just coming more systemically of just making a mistake on some paperwork.
Or not recognizing the potential for the problem to arise. I mean, some people, you know, when they're doing their estate plan or setting up accounts, they don't even think. They're not even aware that the possibility that those assets could pass to a minor.
Exactly. And you know, I think that is prudent of any estate planning attorney to consider that when they are drafting documents, to consider the family dynamic always, and to determine whether or not what they're putting in place could end up leading to a guardianship.
Right. Well, we always insist for our estate plans that include, you know, families, that they name the guardian in the will or the trust document, because just to avoid that scenario.
Yes, I agree with you. Unfortunately, you can do a lot in planning.
Yeah.
And it can still go wrong.
Absolutely.
So, you know, we'd be mindful of that and we try to put the best things in place for folks. But at the end of the day, even if, you know, you have a perfectly executed power of attorney, for example, there may come a time where it's not going to work and a guardianship actually has to be sought.
Sure. All right. So that's one kind of scenario where you have minors who are inheriting typically. And the other type is, I'm assuming, disabled adults.
And yeah. Those generally don't come through the front door on happy terms.
Yeah.
It's generally when someone is quite elderly. Maybe there's some discrepancy amongst the kids of who should be managing mom's assets. Maybe they've tried to do some things, access mom's assets, and someone else has found out about it. Adult Protective Services could be involved. And those cases are generally not as routine,
right,
as the minor children.
So then how do cases come to your front door? How do you market your practice? And is it different for each kind of category of clientele?
All right. So you want to hear a story about how I messed up?
Sure.
So I'll go ahead.
Love those.
I'll go ahead and own it. And particularly because, as I mentioned, my paralegal Elizabeth Brett is here with me. I still do not have an active website after 2 years with my practice. And so my marketing and getting on top of that prior to kind of delving into just doing the work, I didn't quite do that in the right order.
No, I don't think there's any set order. You're not alone in that regard, but go ahead.
But, you know, I think looking back on it, I would much prefer, now that I'm fully into my practice for 2 years on my own, and now having to go back and set up some of those things where when I was just starting out and had more time and less client work, that probably would have been a little bit easier.
Sure. Yeah.
Than it is now, that I have substantial client work, and yet I'm still trying to put some of those fundamental things in place.
Well, that's great news. Good news, bad news. I mean, it's great news that you have substantial client work. How did most of those clients arrive?
Most of those clients arrived because I worked for the Circuit Court for Baltimore County for 2 years. And just by word of mouth, meeting the attorneys who are in this practice, it's not a huge amount of us. Mm-hmm. It's a smaller field. We mostly know each other. And I built up those relationships while I was working with the court. And so when I decided to go out on my own, I had a lot of folks willing to make some referrals.
Okay, so is it estate planning attorneys who are referring potential guardianship cases to you, or family law attorneys, or child, you know, protective services?
I would say all of the above. I got a text message yesterday morning from someone who, she is an attorney, but she does not practice. She works for the Office of Judicial courts or whatever it is down in Annapolis. And she said, Margo, I've had a case referred to me for financial exploitation of a disabled adult. Can I send your information on? I said, of course, absolutely. So it really is kind of day by day.
Yeah.
I'd love to say I have a firm marketing plan in place and that, and I have a complete goal of how to grow and run the business. But the truth is I have a specialization and folks know that. And when those issues come up,
you're one of the people that they call. Well, yeah, and that's the good news in that, you know, and at some point in time, obviously you'll kind of have the rest of the operation catch up with that success. And frankly, you know, for most people, that's a good problem to have. I got too much work, so much work that I'm having a little trouble getting some of these other things online. Well, then let's talk a little bit about your practice. So you've been in practice for a couple of years now. When you came out of law school, did you go straight into solo practice or did you work with a firm for a while?
No, I worked for a couple different firms for a while before I joined the circuit court for Baltimore County.
Okay, so I thought you did the work for the firms while you were in law school, but after you got out of law school, you worked for a couple of firms, then went to the courthouse.
That's correct.
Ah, okay. And then, so you were well out of law school then, or at least free and clear from law school by the time you opened your solo practice.
That's correct. I had about 3 or 4 years of experience.
And how did you start
in my own practice?
How did you start out? Did you start out working at the kitchen table or did you take some office space somewhere or was Starbucks your friend? What was the physical relationship?
You don't know how right you are. thankfully, my father built me this beautiful dining room table. And so that's where I conduct most of my meetings in my house currently. I am transitioning right now, actually. We are going to be expanding a little bit and potential office space and going even further. But I have been working out of my home since I started the practice in October 2017.
And how's that working out? You're finding that challenging or great or less than optimal?
I think it varies day to day. Some days when I can just put sweatpants on and go to my second floor and work, that's excellent. Some days I need to get out and talk to people and not feel quite as cooped up as I can.
Yeah, I think that's true. I work mostly from home and it's a real danger. You can get cocooned in your office space. And unless you force yourself to get out there, it can be daunting.
Yeah. And I think the other thing is, you know, when you're, at least for me, when I'm passing on the stairs and passing my office, I'm like, oh, I could go do another couple hours
instead of
actually, you know, separating myself from that and going fishing.
Yeah. Well, and that's what people say. It's great for work-life balance, but you have to impose some self-discipline. Otherwise, either you're not going to work at all or you're going to work too much because it's always there and available.
Support for today's episode comes from Ruby Receptionists, dedicated to helping you grow your practice one happy caller at a time. From their offices in Portland, Oregon, Ruby's live remote receptionists create an exceptional experience for your callers by answering calls live with your custom greeting, delighting callers in English or Spanish, transferring calls, taking messages, collecting new client intake, and much more. Just like an in-house receptionist at a fraction of the cost. For 15 years, Ruby has been turning rings into relationships. For more information, call 844-895-7829 or visit callruby.com/lawentrepreneur.
You mentioned that you have your lovely paralegal with you. Tell us about your staffing.
So, yes, Elizabeth is here with me. She came on a couple months ago. I'd really been kind of doing it all by myself up until that point. And the firm is growing and the need for additional help is there. And Elizabeth just recently graduated from law school. She will be taking the July bar and then hopefully coming on with us as a full attorney, you know, somewhere in November when she gets sworn in.
Okay, so she's not too stressed out right now.
I don't think it was her like goal to have to set up this podcast meeting Monday morning. I'm sure she would probably rather be studying right now. But
so when you went to go find a paralegal, what process did you use, if any, and what were you looking for?
It kind of happened organically. I had a signing for an estate planning client one day, and the notary that I was using wasn't available that day. And I just put, I think I put out just a blanket Facebook request. And then Elizabeth responded and she came and was my notary that day. And the clients loved her so much that I started just using her as my notary for all my signings.
Sure.
And then, you know, we got to talking. She and I know a lot of the same people. She's has a lot of great experience in this particular field. And so we just got to talking about an additional relationship.
It seemed like a match made.
You don't know how right you are. So one of my mentors, who is an expert in this field and is really amazing, I won't name drop, but she happened to be working with him. He just recently retired. And so it definitely was very organic and very nice to have someone come on board who I know was taught by someone who also taught me.
Sure. So how are you set up kind of practice-wise in terms of technology or workflow? What's the primary process by which you handle your cases?
Well, I think that's another area where I would say that I've struggled. I don't have a lot of the technology in place that I probably should to manage the workload and to track clients and do things like I really want to do. I do consider myself more than a novice in Excel. And so really I've been using Excel for almost all of my business processes. I think that eventually I'll have to move to a completely client-based management tracking system.
Sure.
I'm not ready to do that yet.
Yeah, you know, I think it all depends practice area to practice area because people, as you just indicated, oftentimes don't understand the power of some of the tools that they already have. And if you have a practice area that lends itself to being managed with something like an Excel spreadsheet, which, by the way, you can do so many powerful things in.
Absolutely.
Then there's no real reason to go further or beyond that. I know in my previous life, when I worked in the space program, the amount of things that we did in a spreadsheet was mind-boggling.
Oh, and absolutely.
So if you know your way around Excel and can use some of the, not even the advanced features, some of the kind of just beyond, as you say, novice features, that may be sufficient for your type of practice, at least for the time being.
For the time being, it certainly is.
How do you track deadlines and things?
So,
because I assume this is a deadline specific practice. You've got court hearings, you've got fiduciary responsibilities, you've got billing issues, and I'll ask you about that in a second.
For every different case that I serve as a fiduciary, whether it be as a guardian of property, as a personal representative of an estate, there are filing requirements and they vary by whether or not you're a PR or a guardian. And right now in Excel, I have that set up to tell me when those reports are due.
Okay, so you get alerts right out of Excel?
I run a report.
Okay, run a report, sure. And you can do that whenever you want?
Yes.
Yeah. And how about billing? I think I understand that you have to submit a bill or an invoice to the court for approval. Is that through a formal pleading?
So for guardians of property, there's a few different ways you can get paid. You're entitled to yearly commissions, which are based on income and corpus of the guardianship estate. However, it is far more prominent to petition the court for counsel fees when an attorney is serving as guardian. So to take commissions, all you have to do is file your annual report and you're automatically entitled to them. To get fees, you do have to file a formal petition with the court, who gets to then review your itemized billing and decide whether or not you've pled your case, that you should be entitled to greater than commissions, but to your fees.
Is that time-consuming process?
No.
Okay.
Not once you've done a few in a few different jurisdictions.
Sure.
And understand by jurisdiction what the court and the judges are looking for. It kind of just becomes a standard form.
Yeah. Yeah. And then in terms of closing out a case, you know, I guess sadly, you know, when the ward passes, that pretty much ends your responsibility. You have some kind of formal closeout that you have to do for the court?
That's correct. You know, I would love to say that most of my wards recover from disability and that's why I'm terminating the guardianship, but unfortunately that's just not the case. No. So when someone passes, one, you've got to get your hands on the death certificate, which can be challenging depending on the nature of the death. And then you file two things, basically. You file your final fiduciary report, which is an accounting up until the date of death. And then you file a petition to terminate based on the death, and you use that death certificate pretty much as Exhibit A.
Yeah. Do you have to make a lot of site visits?
As guardian of property, no, generally, particularly where there is a guardian of person. And I'm not sure if I should explain those.
Go ahead.
Okay. So you do have two different types of guardianships. You have guardianship over someone's person, and you can have guardianship over someone's property. Essentially, it's analogous to the power of attorney or advanced medical directive, right. Who's responsible for what decisions. I do not serve as guardian of person. I only serve as guardian of property.
Really? So you even niche down to half of that?
Correct. It's unusual for attorneys to serve as guardian of person because each jurisdiction has what's called a guardian of last resort for person, which is generally the Department of Aging in that jurisdiction. Some attorneys will serve as guardian of person. I just don't.
Right.
So when you are getting towards the end of this and end of a guardianship, it does matter whether or not there has been a guardian of person. It is far easier to close things out when there has been a guardian of person, but there isn't always. And so,
yeah. Well, so what's on the horizon for you? How do you see this continuing to grow? Or are you happy with where you're at? Or what do you think your future looks like here?
Sure. I would say I'm not happy where I'm at. And I definitely want to grow the business and the relationships. I think that guardianship work is not going away, particularly as the baby boomers are starting to
age out.
And I see opportunity to grow my business. Now, are there challenges to that? Yes. Which is part of the reason why I think, to be candid, you don't have a lot of people, maybe in my age bracket with my experience, starting in on guardianship practice. But Elizabeth and I have sort of a plan to grow for ourselves. And then we actually are going to be in the process of hiring someone probably in the next few weeks.
That's terrific. All right. Well, Margot, you know, thank you for taking the time to be with us today. We actually spent more time actually talking real legal stuff than we normally do on the show. You know, for me, it's just really interesting niche that combines similar kinds of roles and functionality of other types of practice areas. And so I wanted to kind of get into that a little more, and we did. And I really thank you for taking the time to share that with me and with our audience today.
Absolutely. I appreciate you having us.
Well, tell our audience if they want to follow up with you, what's the best way to reach out to you?
The best way to reach out to me is via email. It is M-E, like the word, at MERobertsLaw.com.
Me at MERobertsLaw.com.
Yes.
That sounds terrific. Well, I want to thank you again for being on The Law Entrepreneur, and let's stay in touch.
Thank you so much, Neil.
Well, that will do it for today's episode of The Law Entrepreneur. I'd like to thank our sponsors for making this show possible, the good folks at Call Ruby Receptionists, Market Circle, the makers of Daylight, and our newest sponsor, Jurisdiction, the providers of the Next Level Law Practice Program. So take a moment to visit our show notes and hop on over to their websites for special discounts and savings and other free stuff that you can get, and just support them because they make this podcast possible day in and day out. Also, if you got a couple minutes, pop on over to our own website, thelawentrepreneur.com. We have a couple little articles there. You can also listen to the podcast itself there if you choose to. And sign up for our newsletter or our mailing list. And we don't do a lot. You know, you're not going to bombard you with emails every week. And I do plan on doing a few more this year, but we'd love to have you join our community. And in that sense, you can also go on to our Facebook page. You can find us just by searching on The Law Entrepreneur. You can find out what we got going on a daily basis, sometimes hourly, on the Facebook page. So I'd love to have you join us there. And if you have the time, last but not least, go on over to iTunes, search on The Law Entrepreneur. And if it's something that you believe in and feel strongly about, we'd love for you to leave an honest 5-star review, as well as comments about what you like and dislike about the show, because it does mean a lot to us that you are our community, our listeners, and I want to thank you for making this. So we'll see you next time on The Law Entrepreneur.